Hello, everybody, and a warm welcome to this podcast from Chronic Conditions. Great to be with you. My name is Sarah Davis. I'm a GP with a special interest in diabetes from Cardiff. And it is my pleasure to be joined by my friend and colleague, Dr. Kashif Ali. Hi, Kash.
Hi there. I'm Kash Ali. I'm also a GP. I'm based in Glasgow. I'm a GP partner, and I'm also the primary care lead for the Diabetes Clinical Network for Glasgow and Clyde. Great to see you, Sarah.
Yep, great to be here. Right, so I've got the next kind of 15, 20 minutes together, and we're going to have a little chat, Kash, about, I suppose, where we are with NICE guidance for the management of overweight and obesity, which is very much a hot topic at the moment. Plenty of chatter about the management of people living with obesity at the moment. And I know that the obesity guidance from NICE was updated, I think, middle of 2023, wasn't it? With a few sort of significant updates that I thought were probably worth us having a chat about today. So how did you feel about the updated guidance?
Yes, I think it's quite timely. As we know, there's a lot of talk about obesity generally. People are aware of new treatments. And also, I think amongst the wider public, people are certainly more aware about their weight. And I think it was a timely reminder for primary care and generally for healthcare professionals to look at the identification and the assessment and also our treatment options. So very useful, especially with the new treatments now becoming available.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know there was a bit of focus in the guidance in actually our approach to diagnosing overweight and obesity and the assessment of people, perhaps when they come into the practice or wherever people are working. And BMI, obviously body mass index, something we're familiar with using. You know, a lot of people understand BMI. They sort of get an idea of what it means and what number we should be aiming for. But it's definitely not the perfect tool, is it, Kash?
No, absolutely not. And I think we've both noticed this in our own practices that BMI is not always an accurate predictor of future risks. And we also find that there are patients with particularly high BMI, but may have more muscle bulk or muscle than fat that can contribute to that. And we also find that patients from certain ethnic groups, such as South Asians and from Middle East and from Southeast Asia, tend to develop cardiometabolic disease at a lower BMI. So BMI alone isn't the best predictor for future risks. And what is really interesting about this update in the NICE guideline is that now it is advocating that we measure waist and height ratio. And that's something that's really interesting. I don't know if that's something that you advocate in your own practice or use in your own practice, Sarah.
So I have to say it's not something that I've been frequently doing up until now, but I noticed this in the guidance. So they're advocating checking a waist to height ratio in people with a BMI of less than 35. I think I'm right, aren't they? So we'd need to measure the person's weight, the person's height, and then work out the ratio between the two, because that's a better assessment of central or visceral adiposity, Kash. Am I right?
That's correct. So BMI may underestimate visceral or central adiposity. And we know that increased central adiposity has a direct link with increased risk of cardiometabolic disease, especially diabetes and cardiovascular disease. And that's really apparent again in certain ethnicities. Waist height ratio is something that we don't really tend to use very often in primary care, but there's now a real push amongst NICE, but also other guidelines, to suggest that this is a better way of estimating future risk and also gathering information about central obesity. And what I like about the NICE guideline, it actually has a box which actually, you know, teaches you how to inform patients to measure the waist height ratio using a measuring tape. It gives you a sort of guideline of where to measure, you know, around the waist, you know, between two certain midpoints, and that's identifying your lower part of your ribs and then the top of the hips and using the halfway point, and also breathing out when you take that measurement, but also then using your height, which I think most people are quite comfortable checking. And then the simple ratio really is your waist circumference divided by your height in the same units. And remember to convert inches, height and feet and inches into total inches. And what the guideline suggests is that if we do that ratio and the ratio is below 0.5, then that tends to be very good and healthy. Whereas a ratio of between 0.5 and 0.6 is deemed to have increased risk of cardiometabolic disease, and a ratio of greater than 0.6 would indicate a significantly higher risk of cardiometabolic disease. And that may then allow us to press on with other parameters such as Q-risk 3 and measuring other parameters like such as blood pressure and lipid profile, which we may not have done previously when someone with a BMI of 24 may come in. But if they have a waist height ratio of greater than 0.5, we would then treat them differently.
Yes, it's a really interesting concept. You know, the idea that actually a normal BMI, still you can have that central adiposity, you know, that raised weight to height ratio. I suppose for me, it feels like it's going to take longer to do. You know, we are limited with the time we have during that consultation, but you could get the person to do it at home, couldn't you, to perhaps give you that reading, you know, I suppose to save some time.
Absolutely. I think we now really need help from patients trying to get some of these measurements at home. But I wonder whether this will also be an opportunity for people to attend local pharmacies to check their weights. I think we're all aware of the pressures on primary care settings, and having everyone attend for weight and BMI checks is becoming increasingly difficult. But yes, I think this really requires a whole-scale education process where we need to really publicise to the general public the importance of not only checking weight, but the waist height ratios. And it's something I think that will slowly improve, as we found certainly with weight loss treatments, people are becoming more aware of them. And similarly, I think wider awareness will certainly help.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, I quite agree. I think this is definitely a great step forward. You mentioned briefly, Cash, about ethnicity and the interpretation of BMI in people of different ethnic backgrounds. I think that's worth just touching on a moment, because NICE again takes us through that, I think, doesn't it? Around correcting a BMI for people of certain ethnic backgrounds, a correction factor of 2.5, am I right?
That's correct. And we think that's even a sort of a conservative estimate on the risks. So what NICE certainly suggests is that patients that are South Asian, Chinese or Asian or Middle Eastern, Black African backgrounds are more prone to central obesity, and their cardiometabolic risk occurs at a much lower BMI. So what they suggest is that someone of those ethnic backgrounds tend to be overweight at a BMI over 23. So they suggest a BMI between 23 and 27.4 to be considered overweight in these populations, and that includes myself, and obesity with a BMI greater than 27.5. So that is significantly lower than the wider public.
It's a really interesting concept. And I think, you know, actually there's not that much awareness, but it's really significant, isn't it? Because actually a BMI of 23 is fairly low to me. And, you know, we need to really be aware of this. And my understanding is, so that's because that people of those ethnic backgrounds are more likely to have that central, that visceral adiposity, that active, metabolically active fat, isn't it, around the organs at those lower BMIs. So correcting is really important for us to take into consideration.
Absolutely. And it's that visceral fat that we know leads to the increased cardiometabolic diseases, particularly fatty liver, and that fatty tissue on top of the pancreas can also then increase the risk of diabetes at the lower BMI. And that's really important. But it is an interesting concept about BMI, because we do need to interpret BMI in caution, not only in those people of different ethnicities, but also in older people as well. Because what we find in patients over 65, where we're maybe advocating lower BMI generally, we know that patients that are frail and elderly that have particularly low BMIs are also at increased risk of adverse outcomes. And we know that those who are frail and elderly tend to do better when they've got a slightly higher BMI. So BMI, as we've already mentioned, doesn't always accurately predict future risks. And it's so important to look at other parameters such as central adiposity, but also age needs to be taken into account as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's that holistic approach, isn't it? Which hopefully we're pretty good at doing in primary care, but thinking about the person rather than just that number is vital, isn't it? So, you know, this is fantastic learning, really, really helpful, I think. I suppose for a lot of us, you know, seeing people on a day-to-day basis, having the conversation, you know, raising that conversation, you know, when perhaps someone hasn't come in regarding their weight directly, perhaps some kind of, you know, overweight or obesity related issue, knee pain, for example. Sometimes bringing up weight and its contributory factor and how that might be impacting on that person's health can be quite challenging. And how we go about that and the language that we use when we're talking to people living with overweight and obesity is really important, isn't it? Having that understanding of the complexity of obesity, understanding, you know, that is, you know, there's many reasons why people live with overweight and obesity. And we need to have, again, that holistic approach and ensuring that we're avoiding that blame language, negative language is an important part of this assessment, isn't it?
That's absolutely correct. We know that many conditions that we see in primary care are related to weight and obesity, and it's always quite easy to sometimes look at the immediate picture, but not the long-term causes of the conditions that we treat. But you're absolutely right. Many people, in fact, one in two people are considered to be overweight or obese, and many will already have tried to address this themselves by going onto diets or seeking treatments. And what I really like about the guidelines now is the concept of asking permission to speak about weight, because we know that people will come in with some anxiety and will be certainly apprehensive to bring it up themselves. And we as clinicians can be apprehensive because we know that this is an issue that may take time, and it may overrun our consultations when we're already under so much stress. So I think a really useful tip is to ask permission to speak about their weight and make up a follow-up appointment if it's not something that the patient wishes to discuss at that appointment, or if we feel that we're not equipped or have enough time to tackle it at that consultation. And we don't always need to be the clinician that leads us. They could then see a pharmacist or a healthcare professional other than a GP to get their assessment done and to discuss their options. What I really like is the Canadian Obesity Network's 5 A's, which really begins with asking permission, because it is so important that we make patients feel comfortable and that we work in partnership with our patients to not only assess, but then identify treatment goals and also work as we would with any other chronic disease, which really obesity is. It is something that will be with patients for most of their adult lives. And we have to accept that there will be periods where their weight will go up and down, and these increased risks of comorbidities and associated conditions can be reduced if we help our patients tackle those factors and help them with losing weight. So I think the real important thing for us in primary care is to create a partnership and approach the situation holistically, be mindful of the significant psychological distress that patients sometimes have already gone through getting to this stage, but then be mindful that treatments are available, and it's important that we signpost and help our patients along that journey.
I completely agree with you. And, you know, since I've sort of spent some time doing some learning about the complexity of obesity, my empathy and my ability to have that conversation with people has massively improved. And even, you know, just being able to say to somebody, you know, I understand that you will have tried everything and that you, I'm sure, have lost weight before, but then often regained it. That's not your fault. You know, this is a chronic disease. I think the relief that you see on somebody's face, that you understand that you're not there to tick them off or to tell them to just move more and eat less, that there's more to it than that. That's made a real difference to my consultations, and I think it's so important.
Absolutely. I share that hope that we are getting there. More and more of our colleagues are becoming aware of the impact that obesity has. And you're quite right, saying that to patients, that it's not their fault. This is a disease. Our bodies are programmed to hold on to as much fat as possible, and it does become harder to lose weight as we get older. So, and I think sharing that with patients, and also, you know, giving them hope that there are treatments available is really the starting point.
So I suppose that brings us to the next step. You know, we can have a conversation and we can make a follow-up in primary care. So first of all, how would we identify people who are at higher risk, where a higher level of intervention might be needed, where maybe you're thinking about referrals to tier 3 weight management services, if you have those available to you? And I appreciate that often is actually not the case for many of our colleagues working in primary care. But when would you think about that higher level of intervention? So immediately I'm thinking, you know, with my specialist hat on, people also living with type 2 diabetes, comorbidities.
Absolutely. And that's the key thing, is be mindful of these weight related comorbidities. And these are the patients that we really want to offer a higher level and an expedited intervention. So you're quite right. Type 2 diabetes is really a hot topic. We've seen over the last few years that early intervention and weight loss can help reverse or put patients into remission from type 2 diabetes. But then there's other conditions that will benefit significantly with weight loss: hypertension, cardiovascular disease, heart failure, osteoarthritis, dyslipidemia, and sleep apnea. These are conditions that are listed by NICE now that we really should now be proactive in expediting and offering a higher level of intervention to these patients through weight management services, of course. And obviously, we know historically we've maybe helped patients with a significantly higher BMI, for example, BMI over 50. So we're already aware of some of those parameters, but maybe not so much of the comorbidities, because we don't always take into account that these comorbidities have been caused and then are exacerbated by the weight. So you're absolutely right. These are things that we need to focus on and help our patients.
I mean, there will be some frustrations from colleagues listening saying, "Oh, I know I need to get those people referred, but they're limited in terms of the local services available to them." You know, I know that's often the way that NICE guidance sets these kind of, I suppose, slightly wishful thinking approaches. You know, it would be ideal if we all had those higher tier weight management services to be able to refer to. And hopefully having NICE guidance there helps to drive the availability of those services. But I know that it is very patchy, isn't it, Cash?
Absolutely. And these are the challenges across the country. And I'm sure it's similar in Wales as it is here in Scotland. Tier 3 weight management services are really overwhelmed at the moment. And now with I know we will be talking about treatments, but now with injectable treatments available, many more patients are being referred. But saying that, I think that the important thing for us as primary care clinicians is to be mindful of local referral criteria, these are problems for health boards to take on. That, you know, this is really needs a system-wide approach. It's not the journey does not just begin at tier 3, tier 4. It begins at a population level, and there needs to be wider awareness of the referral criteria for people. And I think the move really should go to self-referral. I think many conditions, many patients who are aware of their weight need not always to go through a healthcare professional. And I think we need to be mindful of making the referral pathway easier for our patients.
Yeah, no, brilliant. I quite agree. So I suppose we've got a few minutes left, and it would be remiss of us not to talk about the treatment approaches for the management of overweight and obesity and what we've got available to us. So good old lifestyle interventions. As we've already mentioned, a lot of people who've been living with obesity all their lives will have tried a lot of these already. In terms of, you know, diets that are available for them to sign up to commercially, exercise. They would have probably done a lot of these over time, won't they? So what is your approach to lifestyle advice for people?
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. I think in terms of lifestyle intervention, we can certainly begin the journey for the patients by directing them to resources such as NHS Inform here in Scotland, and I'm sure NHS websites in England and Wales, and then also referral to weight management services to get a better idea of what patients should be doing to help themselves in terms of diet and increasing their exercise. So we know a combined approach of reducing our calories but also increasing our activity levels will help. But through tier 3 and T4 treatment service, they will get more of a multidisciplinary approach. But certainly in terms of lifestyle, the journey really should begin with just looking at the calories that you're taking, calorie counting, or certainly looking at the volume, and then getting some basic advice on trying to reduce those calories and looking at alternative food groups and alternative foods to help you to begin that journey. But certainly here in Scotland, tier 2 services now grant access to commercial partners such as Slimming World, such as Weight Watchers, and this is a useful starting point for many patients, but not all.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of places are looking at digital solutions as well, aren't they? Sort of online apps. I think there was a paper published fairly recently looking at the potential success of the online approach for advice.
Absolutely. I think we need to have as many options as possible. The digital approach will certainly suit many people who are busy at work and who may not be able to access local in-person services. So I think we need to improve accessibility. We also need to be mindful in patients in whom the English is not their first language. We need to ensure that there are appropriate services available for people in other languages. And you're right, having the digital and remote options is really useful.
Yeah, absolutely. And an advice, you know, that is tailored for different cultural food approaches as well is really important, isn't it? And I suppose that then brings us to the hottest of topics at the moment, which is our injectable therapies that are coming out, gosh, left, right and centre now, I think, aren't they, for the management of obesity. So we had high-dose liraglutide, first of all. Saxenda's been around a while. We've now got high-dose semaglutide, Wegovy, which I know has recently been appraised by NICE for use for the management of obesity, and others on the way as well. So tell us a bit more about where these fit. Should we be using them for everyone? Can we use them for the whole of people's lives? Where are we at?
Yeah, no, this is certainly a hot topic. So we've been aware of Saxenda, and previously you will remember Orlistat, which is still approved by NICE for use in patients with obesity. But most recently in the last year, semaglutide has been advocated by NICE. And this is in patients with a BMI of at least 35, or a BMI between 30 and 34.9 that meet the referral criteria to specialist weight management services. And as we've already mentioned, we should lower the BMI thresholds for patients from ethnicities that are at higher risk of cardiometabolic disease. And they must have at least one weight-related comorbidity. NICE advocate using these injectables through a specialist weight management services. So this is not being asked of primary care at the moment, certainly in NHS England and Wales. But the guideline in terms of how long we should keep patients on these drugs is certainly causing a little bit of concern, because NICE advocate a level of up to 2 years. But we've seen certainly in some trial data that as soon as you stop these medications, that the weight can go on very quickly. But then again, as we've probably seen in our own daily practice era, not all patients will want to have GLP-1 receptor analogues for weight loss, and not all will tolerate it. I know health boards across the country are currently really concerned about the use of these drugs and the cost burden on the budgets that they have. But then again, these are very effective treatments. We've seen in a lot of these trials that they significantly reduce weight, sometimes up to 15% of weight loss in patients, which can lead to remission of comorbidities. So it's a really difficult one. It's a very effective drug, but very expensive. But this will be an individualized option for patients. And that's why it's important that we have these patients assessed for these drugs.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think as with anything new, it has to find its place in terms of how it's used. I agree. I think that 2-year restriction on use is a really tricky one. You know, as you say, the evidence shows people will regain most of the weight when they stop using these. If we're saying obesity is a chronic condition, then we wouldn't stop people's antihypertensives after 2 years, would we? Or their, you know, their metformin for their type 2 diabetes. So, you know, should these be lifelong treatments? That is, I think, you know, the debate that needs to be had, and I'm sure we'll have over time. I've got quite a lot of patients, Cash, that will come and say, I can buy this online, Dr. Davis. You know, would you recommend that I come and do this? So what advice would you give to those patients? I think a lot of our colleagues will be having those conversations.
Yes, and we are acutely aware that there's been a GLP-1 shortage, not only in the UK, but across the world because of the popularity of these drugs. And many of these patients are buying these privately. So I think the first and the most important thing is we need to ensure that our patients are using it according to licensed indications. They're appropriately being followed up by the private provider. And that there is no contraindications to the use of these drugs. There's relatively few contraindications, but it's really important that we remind our patients of those if need be. My view is that if patients have not met the local weight management service criteria, but they meet the indications of using these drugs, then absolutely, if they can afford it, I've supported patients to continue with these drugs, especially if they're losing weight. But we know that's not going to be appropriate for the vast majority of patients who are not going to be able to afford these drugs.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So in the last couple of minutes, what about our third perhaps option in terms of treatment, bariatric surgery? So, you know, few and far between on the NHS, I think. I've had a couple of people actually in my practice who have undergone bariatric surgery on the NHS who have been living with obesity and other comorbidities. Do you think there's a role still for bariatric surgery when we're talking about injectable therapies as an option as well?
It's a great question and a really important point. And interestingly, NICE is now advocating expedited referral to bariatric surgery services for patients who are higher risk, including those patients I'd mentioned earlier, particularly those with a BMI over 40 and those of some ethnic groups with a lower BMI threshold that are at higher increased cardiometabolic risk. So NICE on one hand are advocating earlier referral to bariatric surgery units. But then again, with these new drugs, will all of them need life-changing surgery? I think it's a really big step. And I'm now speaking to surgical colleagues. They're very keen that patients are referred into weight management service and assessed appropriately. And in few patients, bariatric surgery may be the best option for them. They may well have tried other interventions that have not been successful or may not respond to these treatments. And we know that bariatric surgery can lead to significant weight loss and remission of comorbidities such as type 2 diabetes and obstructive sleep apnea. So I think it's being mindful but of these guidelines and that this is an option for patients. But then again, is it always going to be appropriate for patients? And sometimes people underestimate the lifelong change that you will get for bariatric surgery. It's an irreversible option. I know there are now some minor procedures that may be offered for some patients, but in many cases, the irreversibility will put patients off.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a big step. I think we're almost out of time, Cash. We could chat about this for ages, I think. Plenty to talk about, but I think it's been really interesting to catch up on where we are with the NICE guidance update for management of obesity and, of course, the treatment options that we've got out there. So thank you very much to everyone for joining us. And thanks, Cash. It's been great.
Thank you, Sarah. Great chatting to you again.
Speak soon.
Bye.